Hello, and welcome to Writing Our Relations with Food, a podcast series where we meet with guests from across the country to discuss food security and food sovereignty, and how we can make changes to our food system with a focus on Canada. Writing Relations is a national network of adult educators and community organizers working for radical social change, and the series is part of a larger project on food sovereignty and the Sustainable Development Goals. So if you're interested in learning more, please check out our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Today, we're excited to share with you the second part of a roundtable discussion on youth food security and intergenerational food activism. This discussion was recorded at our National Agenda 2030 conference in March 2022, where we welcomed Brandon and Ben from Food Not Bombs Edmonton, Cassidy Deskalichuk from the University of Regina Student Union Pantry, Olivia Voice of the Brandon Manitoba Food Council, Karen Secor of the Parkdale Food Center, and Catherine Lennon from Hungry Zine. In this episode, our guests talk about the impact that food insecurity has on young people. So with this next question, it's thinking about like the young people. And so the question that I'm asking is like, what does food security, like how does food insecurity impact young people? So I'll start off with Benjamin and Brandon.
Thank you very much. Brandon, do you want to start on this one?
Well, you're the school bus driver.
I guess, kids more than me. I will say, oh boy. I guess it depends on largely on what you mean by young people. When we're talking about kids, like I think it's pretty obvious that not having adequate access to food is like obviously hugely detrimental to their health, hugely detrimental to their ability to develop and to grow. For people my age, I'm 33, Brandon's younger than me, but you know, I was in my 20s once as well, and I got married young. And so I will say just food insecurity, not even like not having access to food, but not having a secure, reliable income and thus not a secure, reliable source of food is a massive stress and keeps you from being able to do just about anything else. You know, food is one of our most basic needs. And if you don't have reliable access to food, if you don't know that next week you're going to be able to eat, you can't do anything else. You know, I'm 33 and I drive a school bus part-time because I spent so long in poverty that I had to like give up on my education. I had to give up a lot of things that I should have by rights had access to. And when I say by rights, I mean because I'm a human being, not because I'm special or something, but because I'm a human being, there's these things I should have by rights had access to, but that I had to give up on to make sure that I could feed myself at the end of the day. So I think, and I see that all the time when I'm helping out with FNB, like a lot of the people that we work with who are unhoused or who are vulnerable, you know, there's a remarkable number of young people that we have served through our Helping the Humans program, people who have homes and no access to food or ability to make food or to purchase groceries. And to me, that's just it's egregious. It's egregious that we live in one of the richest countries in the world, and yet we can't even feed all of our people, especially our young people who theoretically are going to be the ones running this country in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. I don't know if you have anything to add, Brandon.
Yeah. The first time I ever thought seriously about hunger beyond like World Vision advertisements on TV or kind of like, you know, your parents telling you, oh, eat all the food on your plate because there's children starving in Africa and it's this faraway problem. I was 7 years old, walking into the first day of third grade at a little elementary school in Cold Lake, Alberta, which is this tiny little town in northern Alberta, just on the border of Saskatchewan. And the janitor at the school out of his own pocket and with his own time, every single day, set up a little table, and he would serve breakfast to kids who came in, and he never refused anybody. So it would be like a little bowl of oatmeal or some toast. And that was really eye-opening, that like, this is a town, like there's some rich kids in the town, but most of the town is not rich. A lot of these kids are, you know, they're children of people who've been deployed, they're children of an impoverished indigenous community, they're children of service workers. They're not necessarily going to come to school having already had breakfast. So, you know, as you get older, I get a broader understanding of these issues, and really thinking about like, okay, what are the consequences of malnutrition on the development of a child? We're not even thinking about malnutrition, but what kind of food are they eating, even if they're getting all of their nutritional value, right? If they are eating exclusively industrialized, high sugar content food, they're going to have severe dental problems. And those severe dental problems are going to lead to severe respiratory problems, right? And severe heart disease issues. And, you know, potentially they're going to suffer from obesity or other forms of malnutrition, right? So, you know, when it comes to those issues, it's not just enough to, you know, throw somebody a can of beans and say, okay, well, this contains all the sodium and all the vitamin A and all the iron that you need, so don't bother me anymore. You really need to think about it on the level of, this is a community of people. Do they have the actual control over their political and economic and social lives to really be able to feed themselves reliably without having to rely on entities that can take it away, like corporations or governments?
Okay, thank you. So move on to Catherine.
So our work is not so frontline as like my amazing colleagues on this panel. So we're not directly involved in providing food or meals to people. But I think it's a really good question. I think that question makes me think about the future and climate change and sort of, so maybe not like emergency food access and like direct kind of like day-to-day meals in terms of food insecurity, but thinking kind of long-term and just how our food systems are changing and how that affects like food sovereignty, you know, in whatever ways you need to access food, agriculture, hunting, gathering, fishing, all these systems. So I think about that. I have a one-year-old, and so just thinking about, yeah, how things are going to shift in his lifetime, that's definitely on my mind. And then I think another big one is, you know, just I think we really need school food programs in Canada. I know Canada, we don't have a national school food program or policy, and there's a lot of other countries around the world where it's amazing, like kids learn like food skills in school, they get and like hot meals, like that, you know, they know they're going to eat at school. And there's also the social and the relationship aspects to that. So I think those are some things that we really need here. And then I think maybe just lastly, I think maybe thinking of like older young folks, I think things like on top of affordability and you know, the link between like income and food insecurity, there's also the access to knowledge, access to land. So I think that's a big challenge for young folks trying to get into gardening and like agriculture. It's really difficult to access like land and resources and financing and knowledge to be contributing to food, like regional food security, in the way of actually being able to grow food. So I think those are some of the things I'd add to this conversation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Cassidy?
Yeah, so I guess being more from the university perspective, so older young folks, but food insecurity impacts university students in like tons of ways, but I'll just speak to my experience. So I guess from working at the university and from being a student myself, food security obviously reduces a student's ability to succeed in their academic career, but also their personal lives, because to think well, you need to eat well. So there's always this idea that the starving student is a rite of passage, but what it really is at the end of the day is it's a hindrance to our physical and our mental health. So I find that students often attribute their ability to do well in academics to how smart they are, and they love to compare themselves to others. And if students aren't achieving a level of academic excellence that they expect from themselves, they blame it on themselves instead of recognizing that it's the society around them's fault. And I find that our society does this to everyone. Like, our individual failings are often attributed to our inability to like work hard enough or to be smart enough, but the blame should be put on, I guess, the society around us that puts tremendous amounts of pressure on us but isn't giving us support in return. So I find that when young folks aren't given the opportunity to like have their basic needs met, they equate it to their value in society, and that's detrimental to your success and to your like your ability to contribute to your greater community. And yeah, it ruins our ability to build supportive communities because people don't see themselves as valuable pieces of our society. Yeah, not to mention all the environmental implications that are awaiting young people now. The world is deteriorating around us, and we have no idea where it's going to be in 10 or 30 or 50 years. And this puts so much pressure on young folks, and it also changes the path of their future. And the way in which our food systems are built now is so market focused that young folks aren't able to experience the social and the ecological relationships that are essential, I think, to building food sovereignty and to nurturing our bodies and nurturing our environment and nurturing our souls.
Go ahead, Olivia.
I wanted to bring it back because I feel like there's a few things that we do to address poverty that I haven't heard mentioned specifically, although I'm not saying that you don't, you might. But I really want to highlight paying a living wage. So one of the reasons we started these social enterprises was to provide opportunities for training and employment and to really walk the talk of paying living wage and making businesses that are sustainable and supportive of our community and breaking down barriers for social inclusion. And we get asked quite often why we charge at the food rescue grocery stores. We accept food donations and we charge a really small amount. It's about 25 cents on the dollar. And by doing this, we're able to meet folks that don't access food banks. And also to create a program that's universally accessible and doesn't have stigma or shame attached to it. We apply a sustainability lens and we focus on rescuing food from the landfill. So when folks access the food rescue grocery store, they're helping to reduce food waste, they're helping to increase sustainability and doing good in the community. And we've seen it really impact people in building relationships. We see people come in and purchase for other people and help each other out that way. And a lot of people are asking for ways to give back, which is amazing. For young people specifically, I also teach workshops in high schools about food insecurity and food security. So we cover household food insecurity, how that's measured, and what that means and actually looks like, using the PROOF data from University of Toronto. And we look at ways of identifying challenges and coming up with solutions. And we discuss some of the really cool things that are happening in Canada and around the world. And one of the greatest things that I see out of those workshops is the young people that are like, you can see the light bulb click, especially those who are experiencing food insecurity. They understand that it's a systemic problem. And they understand why they're experiencing the things that they're experiencing. So there's just that level of understanding is really important. And having someone else to support them in that feeling that they have is really good. And a lot of them ask for ways to be involved in coming up with solutions. So we're working on developing a youth food policy council to to have a way to engage youth and have them to be involved and to amplify their voices in our community.
Okay, thank you. And to Karen.
Yeah, really great answers, everyone. I'll just add a few other things. I know you mentioned the proof study, and they refer to things like anxiety, depression, ADHD, you know, eating disorders, all in use because of not having access to enough food, enough good quality food, culturally appropriate food. I put in the chat a link to a video that we did in 2021 with our neighbors to we interviewed people, videoed them. We also did a survey with our neighbors. And it's people talking about, and some young people talking about how they feel to not have appropriate food, to not have enough food, how they feel going to food banks, and what it feels like when you have really good food to eat, how it gives you joy. And food, like I think it maybe was Cassidy who said, you know, food is this human thing that we should be enjoying together, and it shouldn't be something that we have to be worried about all the time. What we often hear from newcomers, I started accepting something I made up, prescriptions for good food, because there are so many restrictions in this food banking system. So anybody from Ottawa can come to the Parkdale Food Center with a prescription from any medical professional, social worker, with a prescription for good food, and they can get as much fruits and vegetables as they want. So we see many refugees, many newcomers coming, and what they're saying is that they're not used to having all of this processed food, that their children develop digestive issues, that they're having trouble in school, having high cholesterol, even in kids as young as 3 and 4 years old. And you're right, I think maybe Benjamin, you said, you know, having dental issues too. So cereal is a good example of that. You know, you come from another country and all of a sudden you see these boxes of cereal, which food banks often get because the industrial food system, you know, they offload the Tim Hortons Timbit cereal because they can't sell it to people, and it gets offloaded to food banks because that, you know, neoliberalism, you know, beggars can't be choosers. And if you give that out to people, it is designed to be addictive. And that's exactly what happens.
Thank you for listening to this month's episode of Writing Our Relations with Food. We would like to thank our wonderful guests for sharing their knowledge and their insights with us. And from everyone here at Writing Relations Canada, we would like to thank our partner, the John Humphrey Center for Peace and Human Rights, and of course, our funders, the Catherine Donnelly Foundation and the Employment and Social Development Canada, for making this project possible. And we hope you'll join us again next month.